This is the son of PCJ.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch rural broadcasting system in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perrell.
Well, hello everyone. It's very nice to have you with us for another edition of the program, the monthly 55-minute version of Media Network Plus. Coming up today, Radio Canada International Sackville's relay is being dismantled. This week, a Canadian senator brought up the issue, but is time running out? We will also talk about the biggest scandal to hit the BBC in years, the abuse allegations against broadcaster Jimmy Savile. The Communist Party of China is beginning its annual meeting, and what role is social media playing? We're going to be joined by our Beijing correspondent for more. This is Media Network Plus, the show that takes the media and goes through it with a fine-tooth comb. First, here's Paulette McQuarrie with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
France 24 journalist Sonia Dridi filed a police complaint with Egyptian police last Saturday, a day after she was assaulted while reporting on a protest at Tahrir Square in Egypt's capital, Cairo. Dridi had just finished giving a live news report at around 10:30 p.m. on Friday for France 24's French-language television when a crowd of men teamed around her, shoving and grabbing at her body. After a few tense moments, Ashraf Khalil, a correspondent for France 24's English-language television, was eventually able to rescue Dridi from the crowd. On Saturday, France 24 announced that both journalists were safe and in good health. America's broadcast voice in Russia will soon be silenced, following Moscow's ratification of a new law that will force a legendary broadcasting company to abandon the Russian airwaves. Radio Liberty, a division of the U.S.-funded Radio Free Europe, recently fired a large portion of its staff after the passage of a Russian law prohibiting foreign-owned media outlets from broadcasting on AM frequencies. The unexpected mass layoffs came as a shock to RL journalists and Russian human rights activists alike, and spurred accusations that the Obama administration is kowtowing to Russian President Vladimir Putin in his quest to silence the democratic voice that helped topple communism. I think they have already destroyed the radio so much loved and followed by those Russian listeners who stand for freedom and democracy, said Mario Corti, a former director of Radio Liberty's Russian service. They are lying to the media by playing down the scale of the firings. Corti and other insiders believe that RFE's Washington-based leadership used the new law as an excuse to abandon the radio businesses, which had become costly and difficult for DC bureaucrats to control. The Associated Press has promoted Fergus Bell to the newly created position of Social Media and UGC Editor International, signaling that AP is expanding its commitment to social media and user-generated content as global news-gathering resources. In a memo to staff issued on October 15th, Tamer Fakahani, AP Deputy Managing Editor and head of the news agency's Nerve Center, stated, "Fergus established a network of sources in Syria that we could depend on and helped set in place a multi-layered verification process involving AP Television, the Middle East Desk's regional and linguistic experts, and the Nerve Center." With his international focus, Bell will remain based in London and report both to Fakahani and AP Television head of output, Beth Coulson, while also working closely with overall social media editor Eric Carvin in New York. The Democratic Action Party Sri Aman will distribute portable shortwave radios during campaigning to longhouses in the parliamentary area. Branch chief and probable DAP candidate for Sri Aman, Leon Jimat Donald, said they had taken delivery of 150 radio sets. He said this would enable longhouse dwellers to listen to radio-free Sarawak. Campaigning via radio has started, and it is the cheapest and arguably the most effective weapon. According to reports from the ground, radio-free Sarawak is so popular that folk in the longhouses would crowd around the radio to listen to the negative news which affects their lives, but never gets reported in the mainstream media. Many of them said they would prefer to postpone their dinners than miss the daily live broadcast, he claimed. Leon said that DAP Sri Aman has already distributed 160 radio sets to various longhouses. He added that the branch is also conducting voter registration at their Jalan Sabu office. A 40-year-old Ukrainian journalist collaborating with several Russian news outlets has gone missing in Syria. Colleagues and relatives believe she may have been kidnapped. Anhar Kochneva is a Ukrainian citizen and lives in Moscow. Since the ongoing conflict in Syria began in 2011, she has collaborated with several Russian news outlets, including Russia Today. She was an outspoken supporter of Bashar al-Assad's government and frequently criticized opposition forces, which may have been the reason for her possible kidnapping, according to Kochneva's employer, the Utro news outlet. For these and other media news stories, visit the Kim Andrew Elliott blog. You'll find a link to it at the bottom of our homepage at www.pcjmedia.com. That's it for news in the world of media this week. I'm Paulette Macquarie.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399 and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
And by the way, you're listening to Media Network Plus, the monthly 55-minute edition. Just before we recorded this month's program, there was a story that came across our desk. Now, normally we actually would have put this ideally in the 30-minute edition, but that program already went out, so we couldn't do it. But we will have an update next week on this story in the 30-minute edition of the program. It concerns Radio Canada International. As you know, this past summer, Radio Canada International was hit with a massive budget cut, leaving only $2 million for its budget. Languages were cut, staff was cut, all programming was cut. In fact, the only program left is called The Link, and it's 30 minutes, and it's only once a week, and it's kind of a review of what's going on in Canada. Well, back on June 29th, Canadian Senator, the Honorable Hugh Segal, put a notice forward to find out what's going on. Now, I should mention right now that apparently the Sackville relay station is already being dismantled. But on October 25th, this week, he spoke to the Senate at the debate in his speech to bring it up for debate. Now, I want to read you a little bit of what he said. We don't have the audio yet, but next week we're working on having the senator right here on Media Network Plus to talk about what he brought forward. He said, "My concern is not that CBC senior management decided to reduce RCI's budget. I would have preferred the CBC not receive a 10% cut. Facing a 10% cut, however, is understandable that CBC management sought to economize in the corporation. My concern is that a 10% cut in the core grant produces an 80% cut in one service, a vital and important international service. Someone has made a focus and direct choice to target one aspect of the network for effective shutdown. While the management and the board of the CBC are and should be at arm's length, and while they should make their own choices, that does not mean that they should be not accountable for the choices they make. One area of accountability should be facing questions from this chamber, as well as the Chamber of Parliament when necessary." All right, that's how the Honorable Hugh Segal began his speech. He then later on said, "Why has RCI been on the CBC's own cut agenda since 1991? what are the foreign and trade policy impacts of denying China Radio International use of our transmitters, which will happen when Sackville is closed? What are the implications of that? When was the decision made to let them use our facilities, and at what cost? Will the CBC management consult with the broader community, including the residents of Sackville, New Brunswick, with the respect of the disposition of those transmitters? Why did we have few program hours on our international shortwave service? Long before the cuts, then the BBC, Voice of Russia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Cairo, All India Radio, NHK World Radio Japan, Radio France International, Voice of Turkey, Radio Pyongyang, Radio Bulgaria, Radio Australia, Radio Tirana, Radio Romania International, Radio Exterior de España, RDP International, Radio Havana, and Radio Italy. Shortwave service and listeners are increasing massively, according to the BBC. In China, production of shortwave radios can't keep up with the demand worldwide. Grundig's production cannot keep up with them either. Yet, we are exiting this medium of transmission. Why? Well, that was just part of what the senator had to say this past week. We're currently working on having the senator on the program to talk about more in depth on the 30-minute edition next week on this same subject, so do tune in. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The biggest scandal to hit the BBC has shaken up many employees at Britain's public broadcaster, from programming all the way to top management. It started a year ago when BBC Newsnight was planning to air a program to look at allegations that popular personality Jimmy Savile sexually abused children for more than 40 years, sometimes on BBC premises. The editor of the program cancelled the broadcast shortly before it was scheduled to air. Meanwhile, private broadcaster Channel 4 did their own program on the story. After it aired, more allegations surfaced, causing questions to circulate about how much and who at the BBC knew about Sir Jimmy Savile and what he was up to. Was there a cover-up by management to protect an iconic persona the BBC created? And does this story represent an isolated case of abuse at the BBC, or is it part of a much larger problem, one woven invisibly into the fabric of this venerable institution? Now, there are some very ugly allegations, however, and he's passed away now, but since his death, there have been some pretty ugly allegations surrounding him that have come out of the woodwork.
Well, the allegations of sexual abuse involving underage girls, I mean, these allegations go back many, many years, to the 1960s, in fact, and even before that when he was working as a club DJ. And for most of the time within the BBC and other places that he worked, it was rumors. But, you know, a lot of people will say, well, sometimes in every rumor there's also a little bit of truth at the same time. So these rumors, all of a sudden, after he passed away, people started coming forward with their stories. So right now in the UK, there's a big sexual abuse scandal, not just of girls, but also of boys, age between the age of 13 and 15, that happened allegedly on BBC premises and involving Jimmy Savile.
So did you said now people are coming forward, but at the time, people didn't say anything?
Well, not that people said anything, but there was a structure, you know, in Britain. I think what happened is that because of the public image that he had, because he did a lot of work for charity, you know, it was the kind of thing like we've seen this happen before, where a lot of victims of very serious crimes, it could be rape or sexual harassment, won't say anything because they feel that if they did say something and they came out with it, people would say, oh, you're not telling the truth, it's impossible, and just kind of push it aside. Of course, people's attitudes in that respect have started changing around the world. But concerning Jimmy Savile, this was one of the concerns that a lot of people who were abused by him, not just people who were abused by him, but also people that had seen some strange activities take place, were reluctant to come forth with. Because in the UK, Jimmy Savile was, well, untouchable, you know. But this whole thing, Paulette, has opened up a can of worms. I mean, now it's not just about Jimmy Savile and the abuses that allegedly took place at BBC premises. It's gone even further than that.
In what way? What do you mean by that?
Well, people now are starting to question what the BBC and BBC executives knew about what was going on. A lot of people that work at the BBC, who had been working at the BBC for many years, people who had retired maybe a number of years ago, are all coming forward now saying, well, you know, these were rumors that we heard, but we didn't believe it. That was one thing that they're saying. The other thing that they're saying is, in occasions where they did bring it to the attention of the hierarchy at the BBC at the time in the 70s and 80s and even 90s, that they were sort of laughed off and just sort of humored about it and say, oh, they're just rumors.
And so now it's presumably they feel that it's safe now to come forth and tell their story.
Well, they feel that it's safe to come forth and tell their story. I mean, there was one woman on one of the programs that Jimmy worked on, and she had witnessed something when walking into his dressing room. And when she brought it to the attention of the production manager, it was just kind of, nobody took her seriously. But she said everybody had talked about it, but she didn't believe it. And then when she brought it to the attention of the production assistant, the production manager, I should say, a few weeks later, she was dismissed without any reason.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, she's not the only one that has come forward with this story. You know, and it's the kind of thing, like, you know, involving, high-profile cases sometimes, because it's covered so much in the media, you know as well as I do, that sometimes people that had no involvement in the case will come forward and make some type of claim.
Right.
You know, but these are people who, you know, they started coming forward before it got all this media, before it got the media attention that it has been getting. And before it was covered so widely, but everybody's story is exactly the same.
So is there any fallout then at the BBC?
Well, the fallout at the BBC is the BBC now is being scrutinized, because last year, in 2011, the BBC have a news magazine called Newsnight. One of the reporters that works on Newsnight, she had heard these rumors for many years, and she said, you know what, I'm going to launch an investigation to see if these rumors are just gossip or they're based on any type of fact. Now, Savile had just passed away a year before that. So she was preparing this documentary that was supposed to air I think it was the month of October 2011. And the editor of Newsnight canceled the project. He didn't put it on hold. He said, stop investigating it.
Why is that?
Well, this is where it gets odd, because the reporter that was working on it, her producer, they were trying to find an answer why. There were a lot of discussions that took place between her and the editor of Newsnight. And the editor eventually sent her, after some email correspondence, which now has been made public, even the BBC has released these emails publicly, basically saying that he had been getting pressure from the BBC bosses not to run it because the BBC had some special tribute programs at the end of the year paying tribute to Jimmy Savile. He also said that there wasn't enough evidence to back the claims that were being done by this documentary, despite the fact that they were following a 2007 police investigation of Jimmy Savile.
So it was all about optics at the BBC level, executive level.
Yeah. Now, what happened, though, is after the whole thing was canned, Channel 4, which is one of BBC's commercial competitors, did a documentary that aired a few weeks ago about the allegations themselves. They had a criminal investigator doing the documentary. And then it came out afterward, people saying, well, wait a second. Channel 4 did this. Why did the BBC shelve this program? Why did they do it? Were they trying to cover up something? Or were they did they shelve it because certain people were afraid that maybe, you know, maybe because they'd been there for a long time and they knew Jimmy Savile, were they part of, you know, trying to not get these rumors out the way they have been out?
So this story then about canceling that documentary sounds like it's pretty big as well and a big element in this story.
Well, you see, this is where the attention is focused on now. You know, why did the BBC cancel this documentary? Now, Panorama, which is a well-known documentary program at the BBC, earlier this week did a documentary about why Newsnight canceled the documentary. And it is a tale of so many twists and turns that at the end of it, they even said themselves that they don't even have a conclusion yet.
Wow. So it looks sounds like a lot of people covering for themselves.
Yeah. This week, George Entwistle, who's the Director General of the BBC, was summoned to a parliamentary hearing into finding out why the BBC editor of Newsnight, who, by the way, since has stepped down from that position, why did he stop the airing and the production of this program looking into Jimmy Savile? And this is what he had to say.
There's no question in my mind that this is what we now know happened is a very, very grave matter indeed. For somebody to have worked for the BBC and at the BBC over a number of decades and to have been responsible for what the police describe as an unprecedented scale of child sexual exploitation there is no question in my mind this is a very grave matter indeed. And I would seek to show that that the response the BBC has made recognises that gravity.
I think we would all accept that, but you will also be aware that the concern about the handling of this matter by the BBC is raising very serious questions about potential suppression to avoid embarrassment, and obviously some of the allegations which were broadcast last night on Panorama. I mean, would you accept that this has not been handled well by the BBC in the last few weeks?
No, I wouldn't accept that. I would accept that there have been times when we have taken longer to do things than in a perfect world I would have liked. But I think if you look at what we've achieved since the scale of the crisis became clear, I think you would see that we have done much of what we should have done and done it in the right order and with proper respect paid to the right authorities. So if I can start by saying the first thing we did was for me to make contact personally with the police.
Now, Keith, we were talking earlier off air about the culture of sort of silence at the BBC and how difficult it is for people to come forth with their stories. In society in general, it's still hard for victims of sexual abuse to come forward. There's still that stigma and a sense of embarrassment and shame. But there's more to it at the BBC. You were saying that actually their hands, everybody's hands are tied to come forth and blow the whistle on people like Jimmy Savile.
Well, you know, the BBC structure and the organization itself, you know, it's an organization that's respected the world over. And again, I want to stress right now, I am not criticizing the BBC. I still have a lot of respect for what they do. the BBC has always had a history, for example, of it being very difficult for women to move on within the corporation.
Proverbial glass ceiling.
Exactly. Now, Margaret Howard, just tell you quickly about her. Margaret Howard was one of the presenters of the BBC. She was first a studio manager, and eventually she went to doing on-air programming and reading news, and they would not allow her to read news because she was a woman.
Wow.
And there have been a number of cases in the last few years even where, she's showing a little bit of gray hair. If she doesn't change it, we have to dismiss her. And this still goes on today, in this decade, 2011, 2012.
Wow.
Now, you think, go back more than 20 years ago and imagine what it would have been like for a woman to become a BBC executive in the late 1980s, despite the fact that she'd had a number of years of television experience. Well, that was the case with Janet Street Porter, who became a BBC executive in the 1980s. And she talked on a BBC program in Manchester about the culture that existed at the BBC and about Jimmy Savile.
When I went to the BBC as an executive in the late 80s, about 1987, I was aware of the rumours about Jimmy Savile. I was also aware of rumours about other people. There was a culture, and it was a generational thing. In areas of light entertainment, behaviour was tolerated. I feel the reason why these women never came forward before was nobody would have believed them, because Jimmy Savile raised so much money for charity and he used the money that he raised for charity as a bargaining power to buy silence from national newspapers. And if ever there was a time when someone might have blown the whistle on him, he would threaten those newspapers and those reporters that charity money would not go to those hospitals. And I know a female journalist that went to interview him that said straight away, I was really uncomfortable. His behaviour was totally inappropriate. But women, we're going back, to the late 80s, even then, entertainment on television is a very male-dominated area. If you just wouldn't have had a voice. I feel the women have come forward now because he's dead. It's just shocking. But there's no doubt, in my mind, that it happened. No doubt at all.
And is it right that it should be investigated now?
Absolutely.
The question is because
I don't want to talk about people who are around now, but we want to send out a really clear message that if you're underage and if someone's in a position of power because they're a well-known TV presenter or producer or director who can hand out fame to a younger person, you must not abuse your position. Okay. A lot of people knew about it at Television Centre. A lot of people at the BBC knew what was going on.
When you say knew, because a lot of people talk about, I'd heard rumours that and this and that. You're saying
it was certainly more than rumours because it was something that went on a regular basis. But, the women involved were just girls, and some of these girls came from very vulnerable situations. They came from special schools. They came from the places that Jimmy was supposed to be helping. Who would have believed them? And some of the women have said that when they did say something, they were punished.
Well, after hearing that, Keith, I have to say that it dispelled all of my skepticism about this potentially being just a witch hunt at the BBC or against the BBC executive, because I can certainly relate to what she says. Corporate culture, it exists around the world and it is just so prevalent.
Hi, my name's Colin Newell and I'm the editor and creator of DXR.ca. Since the mid-90s, DXR.ca has been the go-to website for timely resources for the DXer, SWL, and broadcast listener. If you're looking for unbiased reviews of the most modern receivers and antennas, or are interested in participating in some of the more lively online forums all about radio, then come on by. DXer.ca, a world band radio website.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio. The Chinese Communist Party is just on the verge of having their annual gathering. Now, this is not just any annual gathering. There's going to be a major leadership change. Hu Jintao is out. A new guy is coming in. But it's also been a very turbulent time concerning the scandal around Bo Xilai, the death of a British businessman, the former chief of police of Qingdao, the wife of Bo Xilai going to jail. It's a lot of gossip, a lot of talk because, well, the party is, of course, not putting information out there. Social media is playing a vital role to inform people and in some cases misinform people as well. But it is nevertheless playing a vital role for people to get information. We're now joined on the line with our correspondent in Beijing, Jocelyn Ford.
Well, it does indeed. Those who read the tea leaves around here do believe that they wanted to settle the Bo Xilai case first. In fact, that there's been this long internal battle going on of Bo Xilai's team versus Hu Jintao's team, Xi Jinping, who's likely to be the next president, and that they were not able to announce the party congress, which will now be on November 8th, until they sorted this out. And it looks like that what they're trying to do is completely eradicate Bo. The reason they're putting out so much information and so much detail about his past wrongdoings is because they want to end his political life forever. He may go to jail. You know, who knows what sort of punishment there will be. But the idea is that if he ever does come out of jail, that he would be sidelined politically. And that would mean his whole team of supporters would also be sidelined. In other words, you cannot do this sort of behavior. You cannot, of course, the accusation, I guess we haven't gone into that much detail about what was really going on behind the scenes. I obviously don't know. But there was talk of a sort of a coup, that he really wanted the top position. He wanted to perhaps kick Xi Jinping, presumably the incoming president, out of the way. And he wasn't really a team player. And the idea is that that sort of behavior will not be tolerated by the Communist Party.
But is there not this danger right now, because they're going after him and because they're releasing all these details of things that he did going back to the 1980s and naming names? Is there this danger that it could, some of these names could, let's say, if you connect the dots, head up to, let's say, Hu Jintao or the next person scheduled to take over from him?
Well, I mean, this is precisely the problem. Once you say, yes, our top leaders have problems that have been going on for decades, of course that's going to draw, people are going to draw the conclusion, well, why didn't they catch it earlier? And do we really believe he's the only guy up to this sort of stuff? And that is sort of risky for the Communist Party.
Now, the big meeting for the officials, of course, is just a few weeks away. Is there any word on whether or not they're going to bring him to trial before this and use it, let's say, as a trophy piece to say, you see, look, the party is going after corruption and going after corrupt officials? Or will they wait till after?
Well, there's plenty of speculation on this, and the China watchers tend to say, oh, well, maybe they're going to try to end, you know, get him out of the way before the incoming leadership takes their place, so that they can, you know, solve this problem once and for all, hopefully. And others say, well, the trial could drag on for quite some time. There have been other similar political trials or trials of high-level politicians in the past that have gone on for a while, so they won't be able to wind this up ahead of the Congress. So, I mean, you know, I certainly don't know the answer to that, but there is speculation on all sides.
Let's now move to social media, Jocelyn. Social media in China is extremely popular. Now, one thing, of course, the Chinese do differently is, even though sites like Twitter and Facebook and others are blocked in China, the Chinese have created their own microblog systems and own their own social media systems where people can go and post information. Of course, there is a certain amount of censorship that does take place. But when you consider that maybe 5 years ago, if something was to happen in government, it would probably take weeks or sometimes years before people really got to know about it. Today, it's almost instantaneous. social media concerning the case of Bo Xilai, has this been playing an important role? I mean, people hear, let's say, the stuff off Xinhua, off Central China Television and other Chinese media, and then they see the stuff off social media. What do people make of this?
This is very interesting. As soon as the announcement came out that Bo Xilai was leaving the political scene here, for sure, the censors stopped censoring some of the language that there basically had been no conversations allowed on social media about Bo Xilai, about his supporters, about the various scandals. Suddenly that was lifted, and within a day, something like 7 million, 7 million messages were out there on social media all about Bo Xilai.
So what happened then, you're saying, is that previously, for example, if somebody put something about Bo Xilai, they had to use, like, what's quite common on some of the microblogs in China, use, like, different words or whatever. I mean, they stopped doing that, and they could actually put, let's say, Bo Xilai.
Right. So he's, you know, fair game for for all of the social media people to beat about. And I think that is rather spectacular. I mean, this one, again, if you try to read between the lines, it could suggest that Bo's people were fairly much in power, at least of the censorship machinery, until last Friday, and that there was some major battle going on, and they were winning. They didn't want his name sullied to any great extent, and suddenly they lost their battle, and okay, he's fair game.
Do you think this could also mean, for example, the officials are saying to themselves, well, you know what, let's use social media to our benefit. Let's not ban these keywords. Let people post this stuff. And you know what? We'll go in as well and post stuff as well and have it spread.
Of course, anything is possible here. But I think, you know, they you have to ask the question of timing. Why then block his name until last Friday, until the announcement that he was being booted out of politics? You know, why not do it before? So I think you really, you know, again, I'm not inside the censorship machinery here, but it does look like it was part of the political battle to keep his name out of the public eye. There was not a lot published about him in mainstream media. In the court cases against his wife and against his former police chief, also, there was nothing very clear about what Bo Xilai's connection to all this was, what he did wrong. So it looked like they had not yet finished discussing that. As you recall, there was a brief period of disappearance of who we believe to be the incoming leader, Xi Jinping, in September, which was also unexplained. You know, perhaps some speculate that he was dealing with these political issues. Others say it had nothing to do with it. But all of these signs suggest that they really needed to settle the Bo Xilai case. So there was an internal, a furious internal battle going on. And now that that's happened, the media is able to write about it. The social media is able to deal with this issue. That's the point of view that I subscribe to.
With the censors lifting this restriction off social media, I mean, in China itself, how do people view the information that they see on social media? I mean, a lot of people in China, of course, are very skeptical of what they see on television, read in newspapers, or hear on the radio. What about, for example, with social media, which is less controlled by censors?
Well, it's a huge rumor mill, of course, and everybody knows that. But at the same time, people feel like they're more likely to get closer to the truth on social media than they are in the official media. And I think there are also suggestions that the social media, of course, it is partially driving what we see in the mainstream media, because a lot of news tips, a lot of reporters take news tips from social media when they can. So, I mean, it's had a very powerful impact on China.
Do you see a time, or has the government already done this, you know, using social media to its advantage, like you see, for example, in the United States, Australia, and the United Kingdom?
Well, I mean, of course, they've been doing that for a long time with the so-called 50 Cent team of planting news and planting ideas. And on the one hand, they censor items they don't want to be discussed publicly. On the other hand, they try to make it look like the average citizen is posting items they do want discussed, when actually some of these people are paid forces by the government. But I think you're also suggesting that they think there may be some forces who think that social media, if you just let people talk among themselves and express themselves, perhaps it'll be sort of a release valve for frustrations in society. It's hard to tell if that's what we're seeing or not, but it is an interesting idea. Among the netizens who've been posting about Boshi Lai, there are more than just a few who are drawing connections to the Cultural Revolution and saying, well, we never had a full reckoning of that. We really, you know, we're seeing sort of a throwback to that in the way this is being handled. Certainly the trials, the showcase trials for Boshi Lai's wife and his police chief left a lot of people wondering what really happened. And you know, it'll be very interesting to see if we get any more real detail when the trial takes place for Boshi Lai, or if it's just going to be another sort of puppet trial and they're going to be staged, trumped up charges, and we'll never really know what happened. But certainly the public is on the lookout for this, and that's thanks in part to the Weibo, to the public media.
Are there any government officials in China that, let's say, will use social media to make announcements? For example, you know, in the United States, you'll see the U.S. presidential candidates, the British prime minister, the Australian prime minister, you know, putting out tweets and putting stuff on Facebook. What about in China?
It does happen. I mean, a lot of local governments have set up accounts and that sort of thing. Whether it's always the sort of announcements people are interested in or not is another matter. But it does happen to a certain extent.
Jocelyn Ford, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, I know what you're saying. Keith, you sound like you're speaking inside a tin can. What happened? Your voice sounds different. Well, that little beep should give you a little bit of a notice. It's because right now, you're hearing my voice through a receiver that we're going to be reviewing today. Not just a receiver, but also a transceiver. As you know, from time to time, we do radio reviews. So I thought we'd break out of the normal mode and review a UHF VHF transceiver. It's a transceiver made by Baofeng, and it's called the UV5R. Now, a few weeks ago, I was looking for decent, inexpensive handheld transceiver that I can use here in Taiwan, and I came across this one. And I have to tell you, I was shocked. I was surprised. It was so good, or I should say it is so good, that I decided to get an extra one, send it off to our own propagation expert, Dan Hensley, have him play with it for a few days so we can do a review. So, Dan Hensley is now standing on the line. Dan, hello.
Well, hello, Keith. Good to hear from you.
Now, Dan, you've had the UV5R now for a little while. What are your first impressions? First, what was your impression when you took it out of the box?
When I took it out of the box, my first impression was that this is a well-built rig. It looked like it was built sturdily and it was well-made. The keys were easy to read. They were really, to me, self-explanatory. I picked up on it pretty quickly.
What's actually interesting about it, first of all, we should mention that, you know, a lot of people think that handheld transceivers are like, you know, $100, $150, $200. But this is not the case with this one. This one is, depending on where you buy it from, starting at around $49 all the way up to $69. So it's quite affordable. What about the performance?
Well, when I first turned it on and inserted the battery prior to turning it on, the performance was wonderful. I mean, I was able to scan through VHF and UHF. I discovered very quickly how to get the FM broadcast band on. The audio was nice and crisp and clear. I noticed the receiver. Although I live in an RF-rich environment, this radio does have a good DSP filter in it. And I got some interference, but it was very minimal and did not compromise the receive performance nearly at all.
So for FM reception, if somebody's really interested in FM DX, it's a very good performing radio then.
I would say so, yeah.
Okay, let's move on to what the radio is really men for? Because I don't know about you, but I've been checking out some of the other reviews online, and everybody loves this radio, but they say one of the things that they find difficult is programming the radio.
Well, that's because I think everybody's gotten used to the, you know, going to the VFO and then just going through the various menus of these newer higher end HTs where you can just automatically, you know, the repeater shift is just automatically set, and all you have to do really is just set your PL or your CTCSS or your DCS tones or your 1750 hertz burst, and you're fine to go. This one does require you actually to go into the menu, set your repeater shift, and then set your PL tone or your DCS or your 1750 hertz, and then you hit menu, then you hit menu again, and you'll hear it say receiving memory. Then what you do is you hit the button to get out of memory, and then you hit the memory button again, and it'll say something along the lines of programming memory or transmitting memory, and you can actually set the channel you want that memory on. It goes from 000 all the way through the top programmable memory in the radio. So while you're doing that, I mean, it gives you actually power to do what you want. And I think the reason Baofeng did this is because this radio is part 90 and 97 certified by the FCC, and it can be used internationally. You have one in your hands in Taipei, so every country does their amateur repeater shifting differently, and the frequencies are different in different ITU regions, so it's really flexible that way.
So really, this is the kind of radio that if somebody, let's say, is traveling and can transfer their license, let's say, to another country while they're visiting, they can also use the radio in that country.
Absolutely, yeah. That's the wonderful thing about the flexibility of this radio, is you can take it overseas and use it.
Can you do that normally with this type of transceiver?
Normally, no, unless you have a piece of commercial gear, which would usually require you to have a programming cable and the software for the rig, and it just is not as easy to deal with. This, you can deal with almost everything from the memory or from the keypad in the menu section.
Now, let's say somebody is a novice, and this is the first one that they've gotten hold of. They just got their license. If you were to rate it on a scale, let's say, from 1 to 10 for it being easy, where would you put it? If somebody was, say, they just got interested and they just got hold of one.
I would say it provides the learning curve that a person needs to actually work with a piece of radio gear. They should learn manually, I think. That's my opinion, before they go and try to use the higher-end HTs with the more complicated memories there, or the more complicated menus, and have to deal with all that. It really teaches you about programming radios and radio functions on these HTs, and it gets you familiar, and there's no replacement for that.
So on a scale from 1 to 10, what do you put it at?
I would put it, if 10 was the best for a learner to have, I would give it a 10.
Now, you've had it for a little while now. Have you been able to connect up to, say, any of the repeaters in your area?
Yes, I have, and the transmitted audio reports on my end that I've received have said that the audio is not too hot and it's not too low.
Let me ask you, Dan, where you are, what are the bands that you cannot use as a radio amateur?
You cannot use anything outside of the amateur radio frequencies for your license privileges. I'm a general, so I have certain HF privileges. Technicians have certain HF privileges, as well as the entire FM band, with the exception of 10-meter FM. That's for generals and higher. So from 2 meters and 70 centimeters, 2 meter running from 144 to 148 megahertz, and then 70 centimeters from 420 to 450 megahertz, which is what this radio covers, a 2 meter and 70 centimeter band, you cannot transmit outside of those bands on this rig legally.
Now, let me ask you, if somebody out there was looking for an inexpensive scanner, would you recommend this radio?
I would not, only because there's no way to prevent transmitting on those frequencies. I mean, even with the repeater shift turned off, even without the CTCSS or DPL tone on, or any other, you know, the 1750 Hertz tone, even without any of that stuff set, you're still transmitting on the frequency. If you hit the PTT by accident, you know, the receiver or another radio on that frequency that's in that area can and will hear you, or it will somehow be detected. And there are a ton of public safety frequencies in my area. Almost everything is allocated either to public service works or public safety, transportation, you know, things like not just public transportation, but the taxis and the limos and aviation transport, and aviation ground operations use UHF and VHF. So I would not recommend it as a scanner unless there was a way to lock out transmit on those frequencies.
Tell you a funny thing actually that just happened. I know somebody here, and they called for a taxi on there. So the taxi guy arrived.
Oh wow!
All right, Dan. Final question. Overall, if you had to rate this radio on a 1 to 10, 10 being the best, 1 being the worst, what would your number be?
I would say for the price it's paid, for the features available on the radio, for the radio's intent and design, I would give it a 10.
All right. Thank you very much, Dan Hensley. But we're not finished with Dan yet. No. Because now it's time for a look at Dan's propagation forecast for the next 7 days. Dan, back to you again.
Here's propagation for the week from October 27th to November 2nd, 2012. The 10.7 centimeter flux starts off at 130 on October 27th, dropping 5 points on October 28th to become 125. Yet another 5-point drop on October 29th, bringing the 10.7 centimeter flux to 120. October 30th through November 1st, 2012, a 10.7 centimeter flux of 110. The final 10.7 centimeter flux reading for the week on November 2nd at 100. The A index is 5 all week long and steady, with a steady KP index of 2 from October 27th to November 2nd. Sunspot 1591 is passing out of view, with 1596, 98, and 99 in view. No large coronal holes on the Earth-facing side of the Sun this week. NOAA forecasters estimated a 75% chance of M-class solar flares and a 20% chance of X flares between October 24th and October 25th. The most likely source is active sunspot AR1598. 1598 erupted on October 23rd at 0322 UTC, producing a strong X1 class solar flare. NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory recorded the extreme ultraviolet flash. Radiation from the flare created waves of ionization in the upper atmosphere over Asia and Australia, the daylit side of Earth, and possibly HF radio blackouts at high latitudes. The blast did not, however, produce a significant coronal mass ejection. No auroras are expected to result from this event. This is the fourth significant flare from AR-1598 since it emerged over the southeastern limb only 3 days ago. This means more flares are probably in the offing, and they will become increasingly Earth-directed as the sunspot turns toward our planet in the days ahead. Stay tuned for updates. Back to you, Keith.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. Well, guess what? We are out of time. Yes, we're out of time for the monthly edition of Media Network Plus. But I want to remind you, you can listen to this show weekly. There's a weekly edition. To find out the information, go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. And you can listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, including the 30-minute edition. If you wish to write us and let us know what you think of the program, our email address is very simple, mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp at pcjmedia.com. So we look forward to hearing from you. So on behalf of Dan Hensley and Paulette McQuarrie, this is Keith Pallon wishing you well, hoping we'll see you again very soon. 73s to you all and 88s to the ladies. We're going to end off with a little bit of Yaz and Alison Moyet as vocalist with Nobody's Diary.
If I wait for just a second more, no, I'll forget what I came here for. My head was so full of things.